care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
4 minutes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir. 4 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Thomas Bledsoe. I'm on behalf of the appellant. I was appointed to represent Robin Renee Vince. I'd like to start by taking up the issue of whether or not the second assignment of error regarding the expert being allowed to return to the courtroom was properly preserved or waived by the failure to object when Dr. Reiners took the stand in rebuttal, or whether a motion to strike his testimony should have been made. Because with respect to that entire issue, if it wasn't preserved, unfortunately I have to concede that it wasn't preserved according to Rule 5A18.
Well, wasn't there an objection earlier on?
There was an objection, Your Honor.
So the question is whether you had to...
Whether that objection was sufficient to cover the entire ground, yes, Your Honor.
Does the statute 801, and now I'm drawing a blank on the number...
401.1?
No, that's not the one. The statute that says if you've made the objection down to
801.384A.
Thank you, that's it.
And that would be my argument, the entire issue was before the court at that point when the objection was made. The Commonwealth's attorney asked for Dr. Reiners to be allowed to return to the courtroom when the defendant's case opened to opine about whether or not the treatment was appropriate. And that exchange did cover the entire field. Dr. Reiners was clearly being allowed to return to the courtroom to hear the appellant's evidence because he was going to be called as a rebuttal witness. No one clearly thought that he was going to be opining in the Commonwealth's attorney's office after the trial was over about whether or not the treatment that the horse received was appropriate. Since the entire issue was in front of the court when he made that ruling, I argue, of course, that the objection was sufficient and properly preserved the entire issue for this court.
Because the trial court was aware of what the issue was, they made the ruling, had the opportunity to do something about it right then and there.
That's correct, Your Honor. That would be my argument. The next issue on that ruling, then, of course, is that it was clearly erroneous. The current exclusion statute, 19.2265.1, tracks the language mentioned in Johnson regarding the mandatory nature of exclusion precisely, pretty precisely matching the statute that was being interpreted in Johnson, which was an older statute, 8-211.1. Honestly, I brought the Brickhouse-Bennett abuse of discretion statute issue into this case, and perhaps that made my life needlessly complicated, but it was a backstop, frankly. But frankly, I think Johnson is controlling. In Johnson, an investigator was specifically allowed to return in the courtroom or remain in the courtroom during a trial, and that conviction was overturned. No ifs, ands, or buts. Since that seemed, again, too easy, to just come in here and wave Johnson and say, well, reverse the conviction. I brought up the abuse of discretion standard from Brickhouse and Bennett, and I believe even using that standard, there was error. The court considered what it's supposed to be a valid request from the prosecutor and reached a conclusion contrary to the plain language of the controlling statute. Given the Brickhouse standard for abuse of discretion, I think we need to talk about intentional impropriety. I tried to be, in the opening brief and even in the reply brief, somewhat subtle about whether or not there was, in fact, intentional impropriety, because I'm loath to make that accusation about another attorney. But frankly, it seems like a win-at-any-cost strategy. The prosecutor reads something from the guides and rules of evidence and doesn't acknowledge that that language is specifically from a rule on the admissibility of expert testimony in a criminal case.
It certainly lends to the expedience of the trial, though, to save having to offer every question to the expert who's been excluded, save having to offer it all in hypothetical questions.
And yet that's the way the rules are. I've heard the definition of quibbling before, Your Honor, though, and with respect to the way that was posed to the court as, well, here's something from the guides and rules of evidence that supports my position. It certainly seems like quibbling. Then she cites a specific statute, 8.01-401.1, that by its own words only applies in civil actions. And in case there's any doubt about whether or not it only applies in civil actions, in 1984 in Simpson v. Commonwealth, 227 Virginia, 557, 318 Southeast 2nd, 386, the Virginia Supreme Court says, in fact, that 8.01-401.1 only applies in civil cases. So one of the main factors in the Brickhouse-Bennett abuse of discretion standard is whether or not there was intentional impropriety. While Ms. Campbell in brief says that I haven't made that accusation of intentional impropriety, the words I did use, while it might not amount to intentional impropriety, certainly leave open the possibility that it does
Well, counsel, in fairness to the prosecutor, when this all first came up, and I'm referencing 56 and 57 in the appendix, you know, the discussion was, Your Honor, I'd like to keep this witness in here because it looks like they're going to go down the road of the medication, and I want them to hear. And what you said is, I think the code allows that in a civil case. I'm not sure that it allows it in criminal matters, Your Honor. And that was essentially all you said until after the court ruled, and then you said, note my objection.
Well, and frankly, I was caught flat-footed by a request for something that I don't think I ever would have considered as a prosecutor asking for myself, as a former prosecutor.
But you would agree this was not exactly a zealous objection to the
And the question that hasn't been raised before this point as to whether or not the objection was, in fact, sufficient. So, frankly, I was struggling to get my iPad awake.
To find something to cite to the court, okay. Well, let me ask you another question. It seems that in cases where a witness has been allowed to sit in a courtroom a witness sits in a courtroom and then comes in and testifies, most of those instances involve situations where the witness himself or herself violates.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, and this is not that case.
That's
I mean,
correct.
This is a situation where the court essentially, you know, initially orders all the witnesses not to and then allows a witness to stay in the courtroom.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then the witness comes in and testifies with no objection.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, getting back to the previous point, I would suggest that the objection I did make as far as timeliness and dealing with the entire issue was sufficient. And second, that's why I would argue primarily that Johnson controls. That's the only case law that I can find on the point of an issue of a judge specifically allowing a witness to remain who should have been excluded, and that is a slightly different situation, but it is certainly a much different situation than a witness who's deliberately violated an exclusion order and then is called to testify.
How was the defendant prejudiced by the court allowing the expert to remain in the courtroom?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that whenever a witness is allowed to remain in a courtroom and hear other testimony, it's inherently prejudicial. That's the whole point of the exclusion statute.
What case do you cite for that principle?
Wake that iPad up.
I can't tell you that there's case law that says.
Okay,
that.
Well, let's talk about it. Let's talk about harmless error. Is it harmless error in this instance because of the nature of what was the testimony in rebuttal?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. But again, that gets back into believing that witness having been allowed to remain and shape his testimony. You don't have any idea how cross-examination would have gone, or rebuttal testimony, rather, would have gone, and it requires a great deal of speculation to say that it didn't affect the judgment of the court in some way that it can be said that was beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is there anything in the rebuttal testimony that was different from what he testified to on direct other than his assessment about the drugs?
Not that I can think of, that I can point to, Your Honor.
So it would really revolve around that issue of the drugs?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
That brings me forward then to the issue of whether or not the doctor's opinion testimony was impermissible expert testimony on an ultimate issue. It was, in fact, permitted to opine that the injuries required emergency veterinary treatment when those injuries occurred. That's first and foremost a legal conclusion. That's a defined term in the code that says that an animal needs treatment to stabilize a life-threatening injury, alleviate suffering, prevent the spread of disease, or prevent the further progression of disease.
Again, counsel, wouldn't that be harmless error? If you read the record, and I'm sure you were there, so you heard it live, but you hear all of the testimony, and it's very cumulative as to the injuries that that horse sustained. So why would that not be harmless error again?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that the evidence of guilt wasn't exactly overwhelming. There were a lot of things that the expert conceded. Those injuries would have healed on their own very likely over time, even though the tendon injury would not have healed on its own without surgery. There's no indication in any of the testimony that earlier surgery or some different course of treatment would have made any difference. He simply couldn't say what the condition of the horse would have been earlier to say whether or not an earlier surgery would have been somehow more successful. And there's no evidence that the horse was permanently injured by any of this.
Wasn't the ultimate issue in the case whether or not the defendant had withheld medical attention that was needed, and so it was necessary to establish from the Commonwealth's perspective what if any medical attention was needed? But the ultimate issue was whether medical attention that was required had been withheld. And first, do you agree with that premise? And if so, didn't the expert stop short of saying that this defendant withheld needed medical attention?
Well, certainly I agree. There's no way that he pointed a finger at my client and said she withheld something. But again, I do agree that the issue is whether or not emergency medical treatment was denied. But I don't think you can get to the decision that emergency medical treatment was denied without making the conclusion that emergency medical treatment was required. It's part of the statute. It's part of the language of the statute in that case.
Just to make sure you're aware, you're in your rebuttal time. That's fine. You're free to continue, or you can...
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you very much.
Ms. Campbell?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. For the first assignment of error, the trial court correctly allowed the expert witness to testify to an opinion that was not the ultimate issue. The code that the defendant was convicted under reads, a person who deprives any animal of necessary food, drink, shelter, or emergency veterinary treatment. And what the expert in this case testified to was asked, in your opinion, did this horse require emergency veterinary care at the time that this occurred? The expert was not asked, in your opinion, was this horse denied emergency care? Did the defendant deny him care or anything like that? In this case, we don't have a legal conclusion, as cited in numerous cases where the expert has testified to the ultimate issue of fact.
Ms. Campbell, how do you distinguish the Bond case?
The Bond case. This, I think, this case is about when the defendant makes a statement that it's like a building block where the horse, without this testimony, without proving that the horse needed emergency veterinary care, you couldn't get to the withholdal. But just because it's a building block doesn't make it the ultimate issue of fact. For example, if you have someone testify, in a murder case, you have to have someone testify that the victim is dead, but that doesn't mean that a murder occurred. In this case, someone testified that this horse was hurt and needed emergency care, but that doesn't mean that the crime occurred. But it's a different. That's the ultimate issue, is whether this crime occurred. I think that's a very important distinction in why this isn't the ultimate issue of fact. Even though, yes, it's a building block, and the Commonwealth needed to prove in order to get the conviction, but that doesn't make it doesn't preclude this testimony from being offered. And the expert witness was the treating physician. He was the one who saw the horse, testified to how he treated the horse, what the horse needed. These were merely fact medical conclusions that did not go to any sort of legal conclusion or, as the courts have said, it closed the circle so that no other answer could, the trial court was precluded from coming to any other answer. The court was able to analyze the facts individually and come to the conclusion that the defendant had deprived the horse of the emergency veterinary care. And if the court doesn't have any questions, turning to harmless error, in the, for the first assignment of error, there was substantial evidence that this horse, even if you took this statement away, there's substantial evidence from the pictures that were introduced at trial, the testimony of the horse's owner, and the defendant's own testimony that this horse had a serious injury that was not treated by a vet or and needed care. The defendant herself admitted to treating the horse with prescription medications that included painkillers and anti-inflammatories. That shows the defendant knew that this horse was likely suffering and had a serious injury. Turning to the second assignment of error, the Commonwealth argues that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing the expert to remain in the courtroom and testify on rebuttal. We would ask
counsel, what's your best case on that one? I mean, there, as I pointed out to your opposing counsel, there most of the cases that address this are when a witness violates a court order. What's your best case to support that it was not error here?
I'm not sure that I can point to a best case. The Commonwealth acknowledges that the situation is very different and that the trial court allowed this to happen, and the Commonwealth asked for it to happen, and the trial court allowed it to happen.
How can that not be error? Unlike federal court and unlike the civil cases, here we have a plainly worded statute that says you don't get to have the expert sit in the if the witnesses have been excluded. How do we get around that? Doesn't it become automatically an error, even under an abuse of discretion standard, if the plain meaning of the statute has been violated?
The Commonwealth would argue that the statute doesn't specifically say that the expert witness can't be. And in this case, the
case law does, though. We have a Supreme Court case, right?
Correct, but that wasn't an expert witness. That was an investigator. And there is a difference in that the current way the statute is written, it does make a specific point in putting investigators and police officers in the statute. And the Commonwealth's argument is that expert witnesses are different. And I think the trial court specifically addressed that. And what happened here, it wasn't that an investigator or some witness needed to stay in the courtroom for any other reason other than that this was an expert witness who was going to be called back in order to legitimately testify to facts and evidence, which is the purpose of expert witnesses.
But counsel, there's a reason that experts are given hypotheticals. I mean, otherwise there would be an exemption in 295 that says for all witnesses except for experts. I mean, what authority do you point to for your argument on that point, that experts are different?
As I did in brief, I just to come up with point out to the fact that the federal courts tend to allow it, and the other various other authorities I pointed to recognizing
but the federal
that
courts have different
rules. Yes.
Okay.
But the Commonwealth would point to all these cases, Brickhouse, Bennett, and Wolf, that do apply an abuse of discretion standard, and recognizing that it is when a witness has violated the order itself, if there's this court and the Supreme Court have recognized a mechanism that the defendant is not per se prejudiced from a witness listening to testimony, and therefore the Commonwealth asserts there should not be an automatic reversal based on this alleged error. The defendant can't show any error or harm from the trial court's actions, and because the testimony was primarily just a recitation, again, of what he had testified in direct. There was the very small snippet addressing the prescription meds that was new testimony. But, again, that would have been able to come forth in a hypothetical question.
Well, that testimony was essentially, I mean, the defendant essentially testified
that she was
doing it outside the scope of a prescription. And
yeah. And the expert, I think, just on rebuttal kind of clarified that, and those weren't appropriate dosages as well. So that would be the only thing that was really came from her testimony. Everything else was his own treatment and involvement with the horse. And even if you struck his entire rebuttal testimony, he'd already said most of it on direct. And obviously that goes also to the harmless error. But again, the defendant just has not shown any harm or prejudice, just to say that it was pro se prejudicial that the witness remained there. But this court has recognized in other circumstances that it's not, that it should be an abuse of discretion standard, where there's no harm brought by the trial court's actions. Just to reiterate, the pictures, the testimony of the owner, the defendant's own testimony indicated that the horse was in pain, had severe injury, and that veterinary attention was required. To briefly address the impropriety argument, as the court has noticed, that was not raised below. It was never asserted that when the defendant made his objection that the Commonwealth was improper in any way, and for that reason, I do not believe that it's appropriate for the court to address that. And if the court doesn't have any other questions, I would ask that you affirm the conviction.
Hearing none, thank you very much. Mr. Bledsoe, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is going to go primarily to the issue of whether or not Johnson controls and whether or not an expert is somehow different. Commonwealth's argument is that experts are different, yet there's no distinction made whatsoever in the statute. If the General Assembly wants to change the statute, so be it. Let the Attorney General make that argument to the General Assembly. But at this point, there is no exception for experts. Just because other states or the federal government does it doesn't mean it's okay. And this court is bound by Johnson, which is, I believe, controlling on this issue, in saying that any witness that's deliberately allowed by the court to either return or remain, that's an abuse of discretion. And it is an abuse of discretion, because when a trial judge makes a decision that's contrary to the established law, it's automatically an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, can you run through your argument again on the point relating specifically to why you believe that your objection at the front end preserved the witness testifying in rebuttal?
Again, the entire issue was before the court. The judge knew exactly what he was ruling on. He was ruling on allowing the expert to return to the courtroom to testify as a rebuttal witness. The Commonwealth's attorney says, you know, something to the effect that we're getting ready to get into treatment, and I'd like the veterinarian to be in here to determine whether or not, to be able to opine about whether or not that treatment was appropriate. And clearly, the only way he's going to be opining about that is in the courtroom as a rebuttal witness. Again, no one expected that he was going to be sitting in the Commonwealth's attorney's office after the case was decided, jawing with her and opining in there. He was going to be opining in the courtroom. So the trial judge understood exactly what he was ruling on. Let this witness come back in now to be a rebuttal witness. I ask you to reverse the conviction. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. In keeping with our tradition, we will come down and greet counsel, and thereafter we will take up the case of Cecilisi versus the Commonwealth, and the first order of business will be to correct any mispronunciation of that. Thank you.